Say big at Menards and keep cool in the summer heat with a new window air conditioner from Denali Air. Quickly and efficiently cool your spaces with auto and eco modes to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Featuring 3 fan cooling speeds and a remote control, allowing you to cool your space from anywhere in the room. Save big money on Denali Air. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Eric Davison. And I'm very excited to welcome to the podcast today my friend, Eric Baker. Eric's a lecturer on the history of science at Harvard, and he's also an associate editor at The Drift, one of those cool new little magazines that everyone can't stop talking about. But we invited him talk about his recently released book, Make Your Own Job, How the Entrepreneurial Work Ethic Exhausted America. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So let's start with just a basic question. What is a work ethic? What do you mean by a work ethic? And how is this something that could actually be traced historically?
So the basic idea of a work ethic is that all of us find ourselves doing more work than we, strictly speaking, need to. The kind of economics explanation of why we work is because we need to satisfy certain needs, or we want to get a certain amount of money that we can then exchange in order to satisfy our wants and needs. But in reality, we all have the experience, I think, at one point or another, Or of working more than we actually do need to by those mechanisms. And so the question is why. And there are a range of different answers that social theorists have proposed. But an important piece of the puzzle is culture, is ideas, and in particular the set of kind of ideas and cultural codes that we call the work ethic. So in other words, these are kind of scripts or sort of explanations for why work is not just something that you need to put up with in order to get what you want, but is actually something that you should devote yourself to.
And that is the ideology of our podcast. But you start, and the focus of this book is what you term the entrepreneurial work ethic, which you date roughly to the middle of the 1940s, and you trace it in the decades following. Could we maybe take a little of a step back and talk about what are work ethics that you find in U.S. history? Famously, there's the Protestant work ethic. If people have heard the term work ethic, they probably come across it first and maybe totally until this book through Weber. I mean, Weber was that book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, was one of the first things I read in college. And then I kind of then never talked about a work ethic again. But what are earlier work ethics in U.S. history, deep in European history? Do you link them to Protestantism, capitalism? Is there something unique in Europe, in the Anglosphere that the United States comes to embody? Let's talk about this pre-40s moments before we turn to the focus of your book.
Yeah, so there are a variety of different kinds of work ethics I see circulating, even in the era that Weber characterizes as dominated by the Protestant work ethic. You can actually kind of differentiate a few different sort of versions of the kind of Protestant script about work. In the kind of early American Republic, is that there was a kind of Republican work ethic that emphasized the value of work as a means to secure one's status as an independent property owner. You're not kind of dependent on someone else, and that's why you ought to work. So it's a kind of more than material reward, in the sense that it's not just about what you can kind of get from your work, but that it sort of secures your moral status in this particular way. Later in the 19th century, that dream becomes out of reach for a huge swath of the population. It always was out of reach for enslaved people, for women, but by the late 19th century, even a lot of white men are staring down the reality that they're going to be permanently working for someone else their entire lives.
Just a quick question, yeah. As long as I have you here, how does this play into, because I think it's really important for understanding the imagination of the right, this notion of the Jeffersonian yeoman farmer, right? This sort of eclipse of the South after the Civil War. The South dominates the first 60 plus years of U.S. history-ish, and then it's very much linked to this idea. Obviously, this wasn't most people, but the idea of the landowning yeoman farmer, and that is literally the American nation state, and that is the highest embodiment of the nation state. And so the problem, as you presented it and as I see it, is that industrialism hits the United States, and you're not going to be able to do that, though that ideology continues. Does this industrious work ethic that you talk about in the later half of the 19th century, does that relate to that? Does it depart from it? What's going on there?
Yeah, well, so what's interesting is that you see a pretty concerted effort of people, rather than to say, you know, turn the clock back, which is the rhetoric that we experience a lot today. There are a lot of, you know, preachers, sort of moralists, writers of kind of early books in the sort of self-help genre, who actually urge people to accept this new status, who say, you know, yeah, that's that world's gone. You're going to be, you know, working for someone else for the foreseeable future. But then there's almost this kind of, you know, magic that emerges. And you see this in the narratives of Horatio Alger, for example, where, contrary to popular belief, a lot of these stories are actually not about, you know, starting a business. This is a very much a pre-entrepreneurial work ethic. The story of these books is, you know, people, you know, often, you know, young boys, they're working for someone else, you know, the work's kind of shitty, but they put their head down. And then, so eventually they're sort of smiled upon by fortune or by a wealthy older gentleman in many cases, who then sort of rewards them for their virtue, with, prosperity or with the wealth to have own a business of their own or something like this. So there's this idea that, you know, you need to kind of, you know, virtuously, diligently just kind of tolerate this industrial work, and you'll be kind of rewarded for this, hopefully in the fullness of time. And that's kind of the best that you can hope for. And it's kind of surprising to me how popular these ideas were for a period of time. I mean, these books, you know, really were successful in the late 19th century. A lot of people accepted this stuff.
So what happens as the 20th century comes? And in particular, I think that the two major names, Ford and Taylor. So why don't we talk about friend of the pod, Henry Ford, and also Freddie Taylor, as I like, yes. I like to talk to him. We're on personal terms. But what are these two? How do they contribute to this ideal of the work ethic and how it embeds itself in American nationalism?
Yeah. So the book starts with Ford, who I see as a kind of straddling the era of the industrious work ethic, as I call it, and sort of anticipating the subsequent emergence of the entrepreneurial work ethic, because he has this sense that the kind of what's on offer in the world of industrialism in the late 19th century is not working ideologically for him. You know, they increasingly, you know, in the first decades of the 20th century, there's extremely high rates of turnover in his plants. People are opting out of his jobs. You know, he feels that, and even more generally, you know, he sees people, you know, in his class, other wealthy people, in his view, under the malign influence of the Jews, opting for trying to kind of get rich on finance and sort of enjoy a life of idle luxury rather than working again. So he has the sense that, you know, work needs to be kind of restored to its central moral place. It's slipping. And that to do this, it's necessary to kind of summon up this sort of reservoir of kind of creative energy that, you know, he thought that he embodied and that his close associates embodied, and that, you know, he wanted to make Ford. You know, when we think of Ford, we think of the assembly line. But when Ford thought about Ford, he really imagined a kind of tight-knit, sort of charismatic, kind of community where everyone was, you know, really sort of in love with their work and putting themselves into their work. And so to this extent, you know, he kind of is I think one of the first to see that this older industrious work ethic is starting to lose its plausibility, and that a new vision that's focused on creation and charisma needs to take its place. Taylor, on the flip side, you know, is someone who really tries to salvage the industrious work ethic with the carrot of money. You know, he has all kinds of ideas about, you know, how you can reorganize the production process and in order to boost productivity, efficiency, and he believes that that if you implement the right kind of payment scheme, you can get workers to essentially cooperate with these changes to the labor process. You know, you can they can literally reap the rewards of their higher productivity in financial terms. Of course, the issue is that, you know, especially, you know, later into the 20th century, you know, is in the period after World War I, and then, you know, definitely by the time of the Great Depression, it seems that this kind of carrot of financial reward is actually not sufficient.
Before we turn to the Depression, how do Ford and Taylor interact with this thing we call the progressive movement? Because I think a lot of our own modern politics are still playing out the fights of the progressive era. What do they have to say to that movement? How do they emerge from it, or how do they contradict it?
Yeah, well, Taylor is a kind of classic progressive in some way, in that, you know, he really believes in the value of expertise, the possibility of expertise to smooth over social conflicts by creating what today's tech guys like to call a non-zero-sum game. You know, he really believes in the win-win, and the magic of the win-win in some way is that you know, you can, if you have the right sort of, you know, experts sort of shaping everything, then there's a way for, you know, everyone's sort of incentives to be aligned. You know, I think that Ford is more complicated, and in many ways he's a really kind of proudly anti-progressive figure. In some ways, he except for his kind of private army of people who surveil his workers to make sure they're not having sex outside of marriage, he actually keeps his executive his ranks kind of trim. You know, this is the rhetoric of the later 20th century, you know, the lean workforce, but, you know, he's very skeptical of expertise. You know, he sees this as again, a kind of, it's kind of ruining the magic of work. You get these kind of, you know, bureaucrats, you know, who are sort of substituting their kind of abstract rational schemes for the sheer kind of magical joy of work. And so, you know, I think that there's, again, you can kind of see, you know, aspects of you know, different kinds of reactions to this theme of expertise that are, I agree, definitely reminiscent of our own politics in many ways.
And how does this proceed over the course of the 20s with groups like the Rockefeller Foundation, but then also with the advent of modern social science? Because I think those are key to the spreading of these notions of work ethic and how one should approach the problem of industrial society.
Yeah, totally. So a lot of these social scientists are hired to solve this problem that it seems like, you know, as people say today, no one wants to work anymore. The schemes of people like Taylor in particular, who's kind of the first really kind of celebrity sort of management expert, that it seems like this idea of just, you know, let the engineers figure out how to produce and then kind of, you know, make sure the workers get a kickback, you know, that it seems like there's something more that's necessary here. And so a lot of them turn, you know, as American early American social scientists often did, to Germany. They're interested in people like Weber, people like Werner Zumbart, people eventually, like the economist Joseph Schumpeter, who comes over at the end of the 1920s, and this sense that, you know, we can't sort of adopt an engineering mindset. This is becomes their bogeyman, the engineering mindset. Instead, we need to kind of think about the subjective ideas that really kind of animate people, that knit societies together, and in particular, this idea that there's a way of exercising leadership that can mobilize these subjective sentiments in a way that can sort of ultimately, they hope, re-enchant people's relationship with their work.
And how did the NGOs like Rockefeller play into this?
Well, they're the bank. They're financing all of this, and in many cases it's quite straightforward what their interest is. You know, the historians typically describe the funding of the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Memorial, which is the kind of key funder of social science in the 20s, to John Rockefeller Jr.'s publicity crisis in the Ludlow massacre in Colorado in 1914, where the strike breakers fired on not just striking workers at a Rockefeller mine, but their families, and killed a number of women and children. And this sort of precipitated this sort of crisis for the Rockefellers in progressive circles. You know, this wasn't supposed to happen. We were supposed to be able to figure out a kind of win-win. And so they really kind of intensify their quest to figure out, you know, a new way to kind of, you know, re-energize the bonds between a worker and a manager.
I want to talk about the depression, but first let's talk about Harvard. And this is
one of my favorite topics.
One of everyone's favorite topics. Such an interesting place. But let's talk about Harvard and the sort of seeds of this entrepreneurialism, particularly Harvard Business School, and then we could get into the Depression and Avon.
Yeah. So, you know, Harvard Business School is the kind of temple of American management expertise in the early 20th century. It really pioneers the model of graduate education in business, as we know it today, the MBA degree. And, you know, so a lot of they also have their own interest in these questions. For them, you know, the question is kind of, you know, what does it mean to have management expertise of the kind that you're going to come to a school like Harvard Business School to get? You know, why aren't you just going to specialize as an engineer, as Taylor and his followers were? Why aren't you going to be an economist, for example? Why are you going to come to Harvard Business School? What's the special thing that we can offer you? And so they also become quite entranced with these ideas that there's a kind of way of exercising leadership that, you know, can't be kind of reduced to any particular formula, that there's a way of kind of being a leader that people need to kind of learn to embody. And a lot of the Harvard Business School pedagogy that's very famous, the case study for model, for example, and the investments that they pour into business history, are sort of in part kind of geared toward this sense that you need to, you can't just learn, you know, a theory about, you know, what an executive needs to do, but you really need to sort of understand the executive mindset. You need to get a kind of intuitive grasp of, you know, how to deal with business situations. And so by the 1930s, Joseph Schumpeter is working in the Harvard Economics Department. He shares an interest in right-wing politics with many of the leading lights of Harvard Business School, and they get to know each other. And so increasingly, you know, especially by the 1940s, increasingly the Harvard Business School people start describing this kind of leadership that they're interested in as entrepreneurial, that there's what it means to be this kind of, you know, business leader who has the ability to sort of transform his workplace into a sort of, you know, a charismatic community, that just is what it means to be an entrepreneur, as opposed to a mere manager. And this is an idea that, because of Harvard's preeminence, spreads very rapidly. And there are all kinds of, you know, managers from big ticket corporations, in all of the sort of the major blue chip companies, who come to Harvard Business School in order to sort of get training, to meet each other, you know, often, again, in this kind of informal way, to sort of learn the kind of person that they're supposed to be, you know, not just a kind of, you know, theory.
So let's talk about depression entrepreneurship. I was going to say depressing entrepreneurship, but that covers pretty much the whole
thing.
That's
the whole book, actually.
But let's talk about depression entrepreneurship. What does the Great Depression do to this landscape? And in particular, how do we get the emergence of the entrepreneur not as a producer of something, but as a seller of something, and the rise of this Avon, marketing scheme way of being an entrepreneur?
Yeah, totally. So in the early 20th century, people are really worried that, you know, all their work is going to disappear as a result of the rapid changes that industrial capitalism is undergoing. And then in the Depression, you know, it seems like that's actually happened. You have massive unemployment. This is a political crisis. It's also a social crisis, and a cultural crisis. The question is, you know, what do we, you know, okay, so the industrious work ethic, as I call it, was telling you to, you know, just, you know, even if the work that you have is unpleasant, even if you're doing it for someone else, you just got to keep your head down and do it and you'll be rewarded. But, you know, what do you do if you can't find a job, if you can't find a job for years, you know, that all of a sudden this idea of just, you know, keep your head down and chug along on the work that you're sort of allotted, it becomes much easier said than done. But one thing that, even in the depths of the Depression, in some cases, you know, especially in the depths of the Depression, is more salient than ever is the task of selling goods. There's a common sense, you know, even many economists in this period, especially those of a Keynesian persuasion, begin to theorize the Depression in terms of a sort of chronic shortfall of demand. And so a lot of businesses and business experts begin to think about, you know, the ticket out of the Depression is as creating demand. And the Keynesians have ideas about, you know, fiscal policy mechanisms to do this. But in a much, you know, in a kind of more lowbrow way, there's all sorts of, you know, advice proliferating about how you can use the techniques of good old salesmanship to, as the slogan has it, which is definitely in wide circulation at this period, to make your own job. You can, you know, figure out something that, you know, people are willing to pay for, you know, even when their budget's tight, and, you know, you can sell it to them. And so this is really kind of the only growth industry during the Depression. Everything else is contracting, but sales, and especially direct sales, you know, consumer sales, door to door, as the phrase has it, is booming. And a lot of them begin to figure out this interesting new mechanism for organizing their workforces. Again, this is the period when the New Deal is creating modern labor law as we know it, which is very annoying to a lot of employers. And companies like Avon come up with this idea that, you know, well, perhaps not all of our employees actually need to be employees as New Deal labor law defines it. And in fact, maybe hiring them on as independent contractors in this way, maybe there's actually a kind of synergy between this organizational sort of trickery that we're doing and this sort of entrepreneurial subjectivity we're calling on our sales force to embrace in order to scrounge up demand, in order to seize on scarce opportunities. And so, you know, what Avon promises its workers, they say, you are in business for yourself. And when I first read about this, you know, there's great scholarship on this. I could Tina Mako and great archives on Avon in this period as well. You know, I was just stunned by, you know, how closely this seemed to mirror the gig economy of today. You find it here in the 30s.
And would you say this is helping found what becomes a conservative movement after the war? How could you talk a little bit more about how it interacts with the New Deal?
Yeah, totally. Well, it's a way to say, you know, we actually don't need government to solve this unemployment problem. People can solve it themselves by making their own job. And so, you know, a lot of the kind of new breed of self-help writers that are kind of associated with this moment, people like Norman Vincent Peale are.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. Yeah. It's a market we're actually looking to enter. So please nice. Talk about yeah. the history. Yeah.
Well, it is extremely remunerative.
I mean, we're probably going to do some Avon type stuff as well, but the self-help.
Just to start. Well, Jake, yeah. we'll force Jake to.
Could sell products and household products door to door.
Yeah, that's a good American point. Prestige branded cosmetics and
you're your own boss.
Yeah,
like, nothing better.
So you know, again, you know, so Norman Vincent Peale is a kind of apostle of this movement known as New Thought. He has a particularly Christian way of articulating it. Other people sort of gave it in a slightly more sort of secular kind of universalist idiom. But the
I have a question here, actually, just very quickly. It does seem like most of the people associated with this ethic are, until after the war, are not Jewish. Is that correct?
That's right.
And it becomes more Jewish after the war in terms of sort of like social scientific theory. And so that's also an interesting trace.
Yeah, well, and in fact, I would say there's actually a really deep current of anti-Semitism in this
precisely
early 20s. You know, for Zumbart, Schumpeter, and some of his private writings. You know, Norman Vincent Peale is very sympathetic.
Sort of prevented like some emigres from coming over to Harvard.
Yes, yeah. So this is I think definitely. You know, we're thinking about kind of, you know, right wing Christian culture for the most part in this period. And then, you know, one of the interesting pieces of this history is the way that it becomes, you know, there's a particular kind of progressive reformulation of this.
Yeah, it's secularized
after the war. It's secularized,
like a lot of things after World War II.
Yeah,
a lot of Protestant things.
Yeah. You get, you know, Abraham Maslow is one of the big figures. You know, Danny, you and I have you've read my earlier writing on him. You know, he's a Jewish figure and it becomes very important in the sort of psychological reformulation of the idea of entrepreneurship subsequently.
So let's move on and talk about this thing you term entrepreneurial modernity. What do you mean by that? And how does it come into being? How does it build on the processes and people that you just spoke about?
So Schumpeter, his famous book is called The Theory of Economic Development. This is translated into English in the early 1930s. This kind of makes his reputation. And this concept of development becomes increasingly central to all of American politics in the New Deal era and certainly during and after World War II. And this is a process, development, that's often construed in, you know, simultaneously economic, political, social, cultural, and right at the nexus of all of these processes of development. Social scientists and other intellectuals increasingly locate this concept of entrepreneurship, you know, following Schumpeter's lead in part. This isn't just, you know, a kind of teleological process that's sort of, you know, inscribed in advance. There are people, you know, social scientists at this time, you know, who do think about kind of mechanical sort of laws of social development. But there's in even more, I would argue in some ways, actually an even more influential current that says, you know, no, in order to develop, we need the activity of people called entrepreneurs or, you know, people who are being entrepreneurial. And in fact, you know, some eventually, you know, some people like the psychologist David McClelland after the war go so far as to say that development actually just means the spread of an entrepreneurial mindset. It's about the dissemination of a particular kind of psychological disposition that encourage an entire culture and an entire society to be kind of creative in this way, to sort of drive their societies to higher stages of development. This is a really powerful idea that structures so much thinking across political boundaries. You know, there's definitely a kind of New Deal version of this idea, you know, associated with people like David Lilienthal, who, you know, ends up the TVA administrator, who ends up calling for what he calls social entrepreneurs. But, you know, this is also an idea that's very influential in the kind of Sunbelt capitalist communities that, you know, really helped to see the kind of Barry Goldwater right after the war.
Let's place this, what's going on after World War II, in the context of the Cold War, because democracy is really a key term to these people advocating this entrepreneurial work ethic. So first of all, could you talk about the envisaged relationship between democracy and entrepreneurialism, and then maybe take a little step back and how does this relate to this struggle with the Soviet Union? How does this relate to this emergent Cold War liberalism that is coming into being over the course of the 30s, 40s, and 50s and all that good stuff? So democracy, Soviet Union, Cold War liberalism.
Good. I feel like I'm on, you know, pardon the interruption or something. You know, I got my topics to riff on. So, you know, a commonly remarked feature of development in the social sciences, intellectual history at this time, is the redefinition of democracy in psychological terms. Democracy isn't just a system of government, but it's a kind of disposition. It's a way of thinking.
It's creative, right? Yeah. Jamie Cohn Cole talks about this, like this fetish of creativity in the post-war years is very key, and it links directly, as you know, to your own work.
Yeah, totally. So this kind of, you know, psychological vision of democracy, in some sense the connection is there for the picking. It's really obvious. These same kinds of attributes that are thought to kind of define the democratic way of thinking are also attributes that have had been associated for several decades at that point in the social scientific literature with the kind of entrepreneurial disposition. You know, what distinguished entrepreneurial leaders in business from kind of mere bureaucratic managers. And you know, at this time, the picture of the Soviet Union that's American culture is beginning to develop is one of sort of, you know, bureaucracy kind of metastasizing to, you know, horrific extremes. You know, it's a totally regimented society. What makes it totalitarian is that, you know, you have a kind of scheme cooked up by Marxist experts that are, you know, is trying to be sort of imposed on this whole society. And so in other words, it's a kind of the vision that Americans have of what the Soviet Union is about and what, you know, what makes it bad is essentially of one sort of, you know, giant, awful bureaucracy. And so, you know, for this reason, the antithesis of bureaucracy by this point in the mid-20th century, this kind of vernacular opposition between bureaucracy and entrepreneurship has taken hold. So, you know, American democracy is defined in opposition to the Soviet Union, you know, that means increasingly almost, you know, it's a sort of like deductive inference that it's entrepreneurial rather than bureaucratic. And that's the kind of key to the sort of genius of American culture.
And you wrote this essay for this volume on Cold War liberalism. So how does all this embed with liberalism? So we talked about how Avon was small C conservative. We talked about how Taylor was progressive. We talked about how Ford was an anti-progressive. So there are the what's interesting and the protean character of this, the entrepreneurial work ethic is pretty key to its success. But it does seem that in the post-war decades, it comes pretty closely tied into some regards to sort of liberal establishmentarian thinking, with liberals really being hegemonic politically pretty much for the duration of the Cold War, at least in Congress, and to some sense, culturally as well. So what's the relationship between the entrepreneurial work ethic and Cold War liberalism?
Yeah, complete. So, you know, a lot of liberals are, you know, especially Cold War liberals are, you know, they share this diagnostic portrait of the Soviet Union. You know, as you know, of course, you know, part of what Cold War liberalism means is that, you know, liberalism increasingly is defined as anti-communist as much as it is, you know, in terms of the other values that had been associated with the tradition, you know, for centuries preceding. And so, you know, this kind of, you know, anti-communist, the centrality of anti-communism to liberalism at this period, you know, means that there's, these kinds of, you know, ideas in some ways associated with the conservative critique of the left earlier in the 20th century become kind of taken up by liberalism. But because of this connection to development, there's a way to kind of reforge a new vision of how this is, you know, not just a conservative critique of communism, but it's yoked to a new vision of kind of development of progress. It's increasingly taken up in the policymaking circles, you know, the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. There's a widespread sense of how, you know, entrepreneurship can, you know, help to redress poverty, redress underdevelopment, you know, redress inequality, you know, all these kinds of social goals of liberalism. You know, we kind of think of this idea of sort of, you know, pursuing kind of liberal ends through sort of, you know, free market means as a kind of characteristic feature of sort of Bill Clinton style neoliberalism later in the 20th century. But in some ways, with respect to the idea of the connection between entrepreneurship and development, you know, that idea was squarely at the heart of, you know, social policy thinking already in the post-war liberal establishment.
And how does it relate to race? So the envisioned entrepreneur, particularly before World War II, is imagined, it seems like, to be a white person, not always a man, but a woman as well. But how does this relate to ideals of black capitalism and racial uplift?
Yeah, so increasingly, the, you know, poverty itself is racialized in the American imagination, or you know, there's a kind of white poverty that people talk about as you know, characteristic of Appalachia. You know, that's where David Lilienthal is supposed to be working. And then there's a black poverty that's concentrated in the urban core increasingly. And this black poverty is understood as increasingly poverty is in all forms as a matter of underdevelopment. You know, there's a kind of failure to sort of live up to or sort of embody the kinds of, you know, mindset characteristic of entrepreneurialism that essentially, you know, helps to explain why the rest of the United States is thriving while these black communities in the so-called inner city are falling behind. So there's a vision of the black entrepreneur that develops in policymaking circles at this time, you know, essentially as a means of kind of prescribing a sort of catch-up game. You know, the white entrepreneurs kind of have already been around. You know, that this is like the racial wealth gap is increasingly defined as a kind of entrepreneurship gap. So it becomes necessary to kind of, you know, and this is especially in more sort of stridently conservative forms in the Nixon administration, taken up as, again, a kind of alternative to, you know, more radical visions of redressing racial hierarchy, racial inequality, the cultivation of a kind of black entrepreneurial class can sort of lead to a catch-up process.
So things begin to change in the 60s and the 70s. So how does the entrepreneurial work ethic move over the first decades of the two post-war period? And then how do things begin to change with Kennedy? And then maybe it would be worthwhile to talk about Steve Jobs and tech and the whole Earth catalog and how those relate to what you're talking about here.
So this post-war liberal establishment starts to kind of come into crisis little by little, and in particular, one of the many crises that it confronts is a failure to provide meaningful work to the professional managerial class, to these you know, they poured a lot of money and ingenuity into, you know, educating a wider stratum of American society than ever before, and a lot of these educated young people are really dissatisfied with the work that they have on tap. But this, you know, at this point, this kind of idea of entrepreneurship, creating your own job, you know, this is a resource that people are able to kind of seize on in kind of post-war liberal ideology and sort of refashion it to, you know, help them envision how they're going to chart their own path. So, you know, one version of this process plays out in the counterculture. You know, people with more kind of, you know, hippie-ish sensibilities have all kinds of ideas about, you know, the jobs that they can create, whether that's sort of, you know, in the kind of public policy advocacy realm, you know, in the lines of someone like Ralph Nader and his citizen entrepreneurs, but, you know, also in tech and natural foods and the kind of, you know, new age industrial complex. But then there's a parallel version of this that also takes place, you know, on the right. You have a kind of educated core of, you know, sort of new, you know, new right people styling themselves in contrast to a new left, who are also, you know, entering the executive ranks and are sort of feel that kind of East Coast establishment business culture is a threat to their right wing values, and so they increasingly, you know, start to try to sort of develop their own version of again using the power of entrepreneurship to sort of create the kinds of jobs that embody their values, you know, whether that's in, you know, fast food franchising, it's like Walmart, you know, Coke Industries is another one I talk about. You know, there's this kind of parallel processes of kind of dissatisfaction with mainstream post-war liberalism that, you know, ironically, I kind of recapitulate this theme of sort of, you know, entrepreneurial sort of work creation as its their kind of central motif.
What do you think explains its ability to move from Cold War liberalism to the hippie counterculture to the new right of Ray Kroc and Charles Koch? How is it able to do that? There, it seems like it's tapping into almost a deeper substrate here, particularly in the post-war decades. It seems like it's relatively coherent, roughly, in the first half of the 20th century, even though, like you said, Ford's anti-progressive, Taylor's mega-progressive. There's this protean nature to this that I think is a really key feature of it. And I'm curious, what do you think? Is it something about U.S. culture? Is it something about how Americans understand themselves? How is this entrepreneurial spirit able to basically colonize the mind of all elites?
Well, I think that there are a variety. There's no kind of one trick to it. I think there are a few different factors that are important. One is that I think that the connection to psychology is so crucial. Because, I mean, psychology in 20th century American culture becomes the kind of ultimate way of sort of shuttling ideas into, of kind of giving people ideas about who they are, you know, the purpose of their life.
Right. This is Ellen Herman's The Romance of American Psychology, yeah, where it explains like the advent of this type of language, and it becomes a lingua franca of post-war American life.
And a lingua franca where a lot of people don't even see the politics, again, because it's an expert discourse, you know, there's a kind of a sense of the value neutrality of psychology. So the fact that, you know, when people, regardless of their political commitments, you know, if they're given advice, you know, it says, you know, psychological science says entrepreneurship is the key to happiness. I do think that there's a part of, you know, people's kind of political critique brain that shuts down when that magic phrase is uttered, you know, studies say. And I think that that's a big part of it. You know, I think the other thing is that, you know, the, unlike some other ideologies, you know, entrepreneurship, the entrepreneurial work ethic offers a kind of built-in explanation for its own failure. you know, there's a sense that, you know, precisely because it sees success and failure in terms of, you know, sort of like mindset, psychological attributes, you know, can always say, well, it's not surprising if, you know, it turns out that, you know, you've tried to follow this advice and, you know, you're dissatisfied, because, you know, there are powerful kind of countervailing forces, you know, working against us. There is a kind of, you know, bureaucratic sort of sensibility. You know, it's entrepreneurship, despite the fact that it's, you know, I think in many ways the dominant ideology in American capitalist culture today, it has a way of framing itself as kind of, you know, always kind of correcting the mistakes of dominant culture. It's, you know, we're moving into a new era. You know, mistakes have been made. You know, where we've ended up isn't working for people, but it's possible to sort of, you know, chart a new path. And it's, I think that maneuver that helps to explain why, you know, different, you know, no matter what your value commitments are, it's easy to tell a different version of that story, a version of that same story that sort of works for your worldview, your narrative about society.
How do things proceed between, let's say, the 80s and the 2000s? And then I want to close with where do you think this spirit, you know, exists today in the Andrew Tates of the world? But what happens in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s? The Reagan Revolution, you have Richard Florida talking about creative workers. There's a lot of things happening.
Yeah, totally. And this is often where people, you know, this is the part of the story that people know best, the part of the story that people have lived in many cases. You know, part of it is that, so, you know, throughout the 20th century, entrepreneurship has had, it had competitors, you know, whether that was a more kind of, you know, bureaucratic, you know, rational model of management that was, you know, advocated by a lot of social scientists, advocated in the business schools in many cases, you know, kind of more solidaristic model of, you know, what to do in the face of economic precarity, advocated by the labor movement. In the late 20th century, you know, all of those competitors really start to disintegrate. The labor movement falls on really tough times. The kind of economic crisis of the 1970s and subsequent challenges later in the 20th century, especially the rise of you know, global competition in the manufacturing sector, it seems to discredit the sort of, you know, the egghead style of business management. And so, you know, entrepreneurship really becomes kind of the only game in town. And so I think there's a sort of new degree of real cultural hegemony that it achieves. So, you know, a lot of the kind of older, more established corporations that, you know, may have dabbled in more kind of entrepreneurial management styles, you know, but also still sort of retained a certain kind of, you know, bureaucratic approach. They get really gung-ho on entrepreneurship, often aided and abetted by private equity takeovers. You know, this is the age of restructuring, you know, slashing workforces, you know, often kind of ranking, assessing employees based on how entrepreneurial they are, and eliminating those who are, you know, seem to not have that spark. But then at the same time, there's also you know, all kinds of social crises that develop as a result of this, you know, crises of, again, intensified poverty in the inner city. This is a major discourse in the 1990s, the underclass, problems of global development, you know, environmental problems, problems of inequality. And so there's also a significant kind of reboot of the discourse of social entrepreneurship, of entrepreneurial policymaking, you know, entrepreneurship as a kind of panacea for all manners of social problems.
Is that linked to millennials? Because when in sort of the discourse around this, people are like, I remember the 6 months I worked a corporate job after college, they're like, millennials fucking love doing good well. You know, they want Nike to contribute money to various funds, even as they exploit workers. Like, what explains this return? I mean, this I think has been our adult lives, this emphasis on, like, you could work for the man, but the man is going to do social entrepreneurship shit. So, like, what is that?
We can have the, like, people working in the sweatshop stamp like a Martin Luther King quote on the side of the,
exactly.
the running shoe.
Yeah. Oh, it's so fucking grim.
Right. Totally. Well, I think that part of it is like the counterculture sort of comes of age. It becomes kind of, it achieves its own kind of hegemony. So, you know, you see a lot more kind of mainstream corporations trying to kind of capture this sort of segment, you know, people kind of really raised on these, and, you know, not just values, but this aesthetic. You know, so I do think that it's in the way that these people think about the world, it is actually, you know, my feeling is kind of more supply driven than demand driven. You know, I think that it's more kind of, you know, the Nikes of the world, you know, are kind of, they see this as a way, you know, they recognize, you know, a certain kind of cultural sensibility that's become, you know, really pervasive as a result of the kind of cultural power of the 1960s, and, you know, they're kind of seeking to kind of capture it. You know, I think that even though there are general generational shifts, you know, ebbs and flows, it is remarkable to me how many ideas that I thought were characteristic of my own sort of upbringing and culture as a millennial that, you know, I found actually way deeper in the historical record than I was expecting.
So, Eric, this is it, right? We're in the golden age of these people, right? They're in control of everything now. The folks who want to, you know, move fast and break shit, even if what they're breaking is the United States of America and all the people in it, that who want to, you know, expect, if you're not working 120 hours a week and sleeping on a cot in your office, then you're a slacker and we don't want anything to do with you and you should die. They're in charge of the government now. Like, they're running the Trump administration.
Yeah. But
prior to that, we saw successive administrations, you know, the Obama, first Trump, Biden, coddle this kind of Silicon Valley, you know, I did this all on my own, fuck you, you know, I'm going to do what I want. And this whole ethos has become preeminent in American society. So I guess my question is, where do we stand now, and how long can this last? Because we've got, like, they are going to bring on the climate apocalypse at some point, and this is not going to be able to continue. So, like, what's the future look like for this ethos?
Yeah, well, again, because the magic of entrepreneurship is its ability to sort of blame all problems on, you know, on a failure to be adequately entrepreneurial. You know, I imagine that no matter how bad our crisis gets, at least for a period of time, there will always be people coming up with visions of, you know, how entrepreneurship can solve it. Again, unlike other ideologies that try to say, you know, there are no problems, you know, there is no crisis. You know, entrepreneurship, the entrepreneurial work ethic says, you know, no, there are lots of problems. The old ways aren't working. That's why we need entrepreneurs to come up with new ones. So I do anticipate that this kind of protean, perpetually self-revolutionary, self-reinventing character will continue. You know, that being said, I do also think that, you know, just like in the Great Depression, where there was a great upswell of interest in entrepreneurialism, but there was also a kind of equal and opposite swell of interest in other ways of confronting the social crisis. You know, I think that there will, I mean, I have to believe that people will, you know, there will be people who be disillusioned by, you know, seeing these kind of self-styled, you know, embodiments of the entrepreneurial ethos, you know, come into power and just totally wreck shit. And, you know, I think that is potentially, potentially reason for hope, reason to imagine that, you know, again, as I was saying, you know, there have not been many competitors, to the entrepreneurial ethos with much traction in American society, American culture, you know, for a long time, really for the last half century. And so, you know, I'm hoping that this is potentially an inflection point where, you know, if I don't expect entrepreneurialism to disappear anytime soon, but, you know, we may get back to an earlier period where it was sort of one competing ideological current among others.
So maybe this is an ignorant question, but it seems like tough to imagine that because there's no other option, really. Like even this podcast is an entrepreneurial podcast. Someone once on one of the left-wing podcasts was like, "Don't listen to me; I'm a small business owner." You know, so how does that work? It does seem like there's no option for non-entrepreneurialism unless you want to, you know, retreat and be a monkish type person. Have you thought about that? Like, what would another option even be in modern capitalism?
Well, Danny, yes.
Which, by the way, isn't late stage. It's just fucking capitalism.
I have indeed thought about it, and it makes me very sad. So I hope you're happy. I agree. It's the definition of easier said than done. I mean, one of the ironic conclusions of, you know, doing this work is that there's so much of the language that we use on the left for sort of talking about what the solution is, you know, or sort of imagining new possibilities, all this stuff. You know, there is a kind of resonance between this language and what the advocates of entrepreneurship, how they talk about the world. And so, you know, I do think that there is a real the sense of being trapped in the matrix is a real one. And you know, I think we should not underestimate the difficulties of, you know, creating new ideological alternatives. Or, you know, I think we should be attentive to the way that, you know, we all can sort of succumb to replicating some of the elements of this ideology in our own work. But I do think that there are projects that, you know, seek to, I think especially to dull the impact of precarity, which I think is the single biggest sort of engine driving the appeal of entrepreneurialism, the fact that you know, you kind of the feeling that you need to kind of constantly stay one step ahead of the market, because if the market catches up to you, you're fucked. So, you know, I think that, you know, all the organizing projects that people, you know, have to try to kind of, you know, make it so that people feel like there's a little more room for error, that can, I think, maybe dull the blade of entrepreneurship a little bit.
And we didn't even get into the fact that as an academic, you're basically trained to be a little entrepreneur and constantly showing yourself off to people. Do you have any final thoughts about the entrepreneurial spirit in academia?
In short, I think that this is, I mean, it's in some sense, this is part of why I wrote this book. You know, I perceived in academia so clearly a connection between this sort of sense of precarity, the sense of a scarcity of work, the sense of kind of the perpetual specter of displacement, and the appeal of entrepreneurial advice, often in that language. You know, the notion, the idea that you need to be more entrepreneurial. And, you know, I also saw the way that, you know, tends to inhibit projects of collective solidarity. And so, you know, in some sense, academia, precisely because it's you know, one of the places where the problem of kind of pervasive worklessness is most acute in professional employment. You know, it's kind of a perfect laboratory, actually, for observing a lot of this stuff.
Everyone, thank you so much for listening. Eric, thank you so much for writing this book. Everyone, buy it. We need to support our academics. And it's titled Make Your Own Job: How the Entrepreneurial Work Ethic Exhausted America. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Get everything for your next project at Menards and save big money. We carry everything to help you breathe easier. Allergen air filters help prevent seasonal allergy symptoms and improve your indoor air quality by capturing microparticles while allowing maximum airflow. Save big on Allergen air filters when you shop at Menards. View the weekly flyer and all of our great deals happening this week on Menards.com. Save.